You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Let's be frank. If I were to ask you if you make great home-cooked meals most weekends, you'd probably say no, especially if it means dashing home from work. But Amanda Hesser and Meryl Stubbs, co-founders of the online kitchen and home company called Food 52, have come up with strategies that are pretty amazing, and they've laid them out with many wonderful recipes in their new book, A New Way to Dinner, which has just been published by 10 Speed Press. So here to help you keep your New Year's resolution to make dinner more often are Amanda Hesser and Meryl Stubbs. Welcome back to our show.
Such a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having us.
For most of us, dinner involves, as I said, rushing home late and suddenly realizing you're out of rice or some other crucial ingredient. Were you big dinner makers before you started working on this cookbook?
We've made a lot of dinner over the years. And it's always been really important to us to not only eat well ourselves, but also for our families to eat well throughout the week. So it's always been a priority. It's just that the way that we go about it has shifted in the past several years as we've become business.
Do you always have rice on hand?
I do. Do you have rice? Yeah, I think that's a staple for both of us.
Yeah, and well, I mean, I sort of think that that taps into what, like, the insight that we had, which is that, you know, I think we were more casual dinner makers. You know, we would throw things together. If we didn't have rice, we'd, you know, improvise. But I think that was also before, you know, we had families, and also before our business took off and our work became really intense. And so, you know, I just think, you know, this, what the time constraints that we face are no different than what many Americans face. Everyone's feeling kind of like they have lots they want to do, things they want to get done. They want to eat well. They want to live well. They want to exercise. They want to have great professions. They want to go on, you know, they want to travel. But you have to, you have to choose, right? And we felt like, you know, given that we run a kitchen and home company and are very experienced cooks, if we're facing this challenge, then think of how many other people are facing it too. And if we could help them out. And the big insight we had was that most people, including us, like, once you're in the kitchen, people are quite happy, right? They're chopping onions, they're getting things, you know,
the people who like to cook. Not everybody does, but I don't understand the ones who don't.
but even those who, you know, who don't love cooking, if they feel like they know what they're doing, that's when they're most comfortable, right?
It's, yeah, the being productive part that I think feels the best.
Yeah. But it's all the lead up to getting in the kitchen is actually what holds people back and what is daunting to people and even daunting to us. Mm-hmm. And so we found ourselves having to, like, both really change the way we lived and the way we, you know, spent our time in order to eat well more successfully. What we didn't realize is that we were both working our way through this kind of change
simultaneously.
But you said often you just throw things together, whatever is in the house, and isn't that what's often recommended? I've had any number of guests who said, yeah, you look in the refrigerator and you figure out that you can put this together with that. You're not recommending that.
No, I mean, and I think that that works sometimes, provided that you have the raw materials on hand that you need. But it also requires you to think in the moment. Even though you're just, you know, looking in the fridge, looking in the pantry, you still have to make a plan right then in the moment.
It's called improvisation.
Yeah, but I think that's intimidating for a lot of people. And it's been intimidating for us as well. It's fun when you have the time to do that. But what we wanted to do was to just take the thinking out of it for people, because that's a barrier, just as time to shop is a barrier. And so our method is about giving people not just great recipes, but also a plan for how to cook ahead and cook these component dishes over the weekend when you can set aside a chunk of time and then combine them over the course of the week so that you have five different delicious dinners that you can get on the table in 10 minutes.
It's been a few years since you were last on the show with us. How much has your startup Food 52 changed over the years, and what relationship does it have to what we're talking about now?
Yeah. I think since the last time we were here, you know, our team was probably somewhere between 10 and 20 people. And, you know, we are now, you know, we're 65 people. We have an audience of 11 million. And it's the business is pretty intense. And so that has kind of shifted the way we spend our time and the sort of the demands that are on us. And so that has played into kind of a need to write this book and to kind of help others who, you know, it doesn't matter if you like run your own business or you just, you know, you work at a law firm or you, you know, you're an artist and you're painting all day. Like it's, people are time crunched, and we felt like there were so many books done before about like cooking ahead, and they often were kind of either they followed the school of thought of like make a big batch of stew and then like, you know, freeze some of it, eat it for 3 days, which to us is like deadly.
Or do variations deadly. On it.
Yeah. The books we felt like just refused to get into the nitty gritty of like actually how you pull this off. And so we decided that, you know, again, like people, they, you know, they like to be in the kitchen once they're actually cooking, but it's the decision. And I think this is actually how our business has affected is that we realize that you need to minimize the number of decisions you're making during the day, especially during the week. And so if we could do all of that, help you with those decisions, like making by coming up with complete menus, telling you what you needed to do on over the weekend, giving you an entire grocery list so you don't have to create it, like do all the sort of frankly like mundane and
stuff.
Boring stuff that keeps people from getting in the kitchen. If we could do that work for you, then we could encourage more people to get in the kitchen and really have good food on hand, which is what we have done for ourselves.
Does having kids complicate the situation? Amanda, you have twins.
Yeah.
Do they share the same food tastes?
Mostly they do. Yeah. I mean, we have always, you know, they've always eaten what we eat. And so I'm sure there are certain things that they don't like. But we, you know, I think that the menus that we've come up with are, you know, they are literally what we cook for our families. And, you know, when we went to write the book, you know, I write down the menus. I handwrite them on printer paper every week, and I keep them. And so when we went to write the book, I really drew from those menus that I'd actually cooked for our family. And Marilyn,
yeah, Amanda's very, very organized. I thought I was organized until I met Amanda.
You have two kids as well.
I do have two kids, and they're 2 and 5. And what I'll say about my menus is that they definitely were conceived keeping in mind the tastes of not just my children, but also my husband. and, you know, it's and my own as well. I mean, they're things that we all gravitate towards. And so for the most part, you know, my menus honor that, but, you know, with some stuff thrown in that might be a little bit new for them.
So were you comparing notes when you were at work together?
Yeah, I mean, well, so we started, what happened is we actually started comparing lunches. That was the first step, because Amanda's very organized menus would yield these beautifully composed grain salads that she would bring in for lunch as a result of sort of the components that she had made over the weekend. And I would always look longingly at those. And then I would have, you know,
it like was mutual
braised chicken or something. and so that's how the conversation started, really, was sort of, oh, what do you have there? When did you make that? Or, you know, how did that come together? And then we'd start talking about how we'd put things, various things together over the weekend, and, you know, how we kind of maximize the time we did have in order to produce great food.
My guests are Meryl Stubbs and Amanda Hesser, co-founders of Food 52 and authors of a book called A New Way to Dinner from 10 Speed Press. By the way, we have included some recipes from the book: red wine, beef stew, slow-cooked pork tacos, and broccoli, garlic, and beans on our show page at wmyc.org/lowpate. Since you say that the goal of both of you was to come up with new ways of cooking, had you turned away from following recipes?
Well, Amanda, you might be.
Yeah.
This might be your topic.
Well, part of what kind of drove me to come up with this approach was that after we had kids and I was, you know, finding that I didn't have quite as much time, I went through a stage of where I thought I was doing the right thing. I was like cooking a lot I was buying, you know, all my ingredients for the weekend and then I, you know, set out to cook on Sunday. But because I was focused on how little time I had, all I would do was roast everything. I was like, you know, I was roasting potatoes and then I was roasting the vegetables and then I would roast some fish and I would roast some pork. And I was so sad and bored.
Keeps the house warm.
Like I was, you know, sad and bored in the kitchen and at the table. And I kind of went through, like, I call it my cooking rut. And what got me out of it was actually just turning back to recipes and getting inspired and following them. There's something very, you know, the beauty of recipes is that they're very comforting, right, if you follow them, right, because it's somebody kind of guiding you along and holding your hand. And I think I found that when I was crunched for time, that was really helpful. So I started pushing myself to, like, instead of, you know, roasting eight things, you know, starting to make some recipes. And then I started tweaking and, you know, if I was making a farro salad, I would make some extra farro, and then maybe I'd make like a, you know, a farro soup with some of that, and so it would add kind of like depth and variety to the menus I had, while also like keeping all of us happier at the table.
But you've been writing recipes for a long time. You did the Essential New York Times cookbook. Mm-hmm. I remember you came here to talk about a time you spent cooking in France. Your relationship with a gardener and learning how to rely on local produce. So did you drift away from recipes?
No, it's just, you know, I was continuing, and as was Meryl, to like create recipes for the site. But in the sort of like regular kind of churn of the weeks of feeding our families, you know, we face the same challenges that everyone else does. Yes, maybe we're, you know, I think that we're very experienced cooks, and that is helpful. I think it was for us really finding that it was actually really helpful to, I feel like, understand the challenges. Because it's not hard for us to get in the kitchen, right? It's a very happy place for us. But, you know, if we're pressed for time and at the end of a long day not feeling like we want to put together a dinner from scratch, then there's probably, you know, something that we can do to help others.
Meryl, the two of you worked together on the Essential New York Times cookbook. Was that a good preparation for this project?
For this book?
Yeah.
Well, yeah,
you've written about in this book.
Yes, I think actually it was because the way we tested recipes was in some ways reminiscent of now what our Sundays look like, right? Mm-hmm. So because Amanda and I would cook on a weeknight, actually, when Amanda would get back from the Times and I would meet her at her apartment and we would spend like a 3 or 4 hour chunk intensely cooking together. And we would cook anywhere from 5 to 7 recipes. And so we're doing the very same thing that we are, you know, sort of promoting with this book, which is to maximize your time in the kitchen and get all of your prep done, that, you know, chop all of your onions at once for multiple recipes.
Did you ever cook together?
We cook together all the time. Yeah.
What happens if you have a busy weekend and you don't have much time to cook on that weekend? Does that throw everything off?
Well, we don't look at it that way as throwing everything off. I mean, this book is basically sort of the what we aspire to ourselves. It's kind of like the epitome of this way of approaching dinner, right? It doesn't mean we always achieve it every week. And in fact, we've laid out ways that you can pare back or make half the recipes one week and still, you know, order out or go out to dinner or whatever it is.
And then you have all these, you suggest all sorts of shortcuts, but you also suggest that you should clean the dishes along the way.
Well, you sort of have to.
You don't want
to
just pile them in the sink again.
But you may need a pot more than once. You know, it's more tactical than anything else, I would say. When we were taught, and we were taught right. We both went to cooking school.
You also offer tips for being more confident in the kitchen, like how to store fresh herbs and greens. Although the both of you do seem to have different methods, and freezing bread and making salad dressings, big salad dressings, and then just keep them in a jar?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just constantly, we're trying to kind of retrain our readers, just like we retrained ourselves, to like just plan differently. Like if you're going to be taking time to make salad dressing, why not make a bigger batch and have it last longer? And
and don't make it in a bowl. Make it in the thing that you can actually then use to store it.
Yeah.
And freezing bread is okay?
Oh yeah,
I'm down with it.
What do you do afterwards? You just let
it
defrost
right
by itself, or do you put it in the oven?
You definitely. I think it needs a little sort of new life that you can get by putting it in the oven for, you know, at 350 for just a few minutes, especially if it's a bread with a nice crust.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, bread can always be baked just a little bit longer.
Exactly.
And everyone loves toast.
Yeah.
My guests are Amanda Hesser and Meryl Stubbs, co-founders of Food 52, and we're talking about a new book that they have written called A New Way to Dinner. The subtitle is A Playbook of Recipes and Strategies for the Week Ahead. We have a number of the recipes on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. You want to check them out. We'll be back with more right after this. We're back with Amanda Hesser and Meryl Stubbs, co-founders of Food 52. Their book, A New Way to Dinner, A Playbook of Recipes and Strategies for the Week Ahead, published by 10 Speed Press. You're saying a new way. What is new about your approach here?
I think it's, as Amanda said a few minutes ago, a lot of people have written books on the topic of weeknight dinners or cooking ahead for the week, but no one has really approached it from a strategic angle, which is really what we wanted to do, and to lay out all of the nitty-gritty that you need in order to be successful with this cooking ahead over the weekend strategy. So it's not just about recipes. It's about laying out the menus, laying out what you need to do not only during the weekend when you're making all of your component dishes, but then what you need to do each night of the week to pull together dinner. And then also giving you all of the groceries you're going to need to pull together every meal, not just the cooking on the weekend, but all the meals throughout the week, so that you just get everything done. It takes the thinking out of it, takes the planning out of it, and really walks you through it every step of the way.
Did you find yourself agreeing on most of the strategies?
Yes.
Yes. Well, we discovered that we both had been doing this and simultaneously and not realizing it. And I think that, you know, we I feel like we borrowed ideas from each other, which was really great. I mean, I make many of the recipe of Meryl's recipes. And in fact, she very kindly let me use her great chicken finger recipe in one of my chapters.
Well, okay, so you have prepared things over the weekend.
Yeah.
And now you're going to pull them out on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Have you put them in the freezer?
You could. Actually, in a couple of my menus, I recommend making sort of a double quantity of something and freezing half of it, not for that week, but for another week. So for example, there's a roasted applesauce recipe that...
Roasted applesauce.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
The roasting, it gives it a deeper flavor?
It does. Yeah. It's also nice because you don't have to babysit it. And so half of it goes into an applesauce cake 1 week. You freeze the other half and then you pull it out and use it basically as an accompaniment to a different cake for a dessert in a following week.
But then the next question is, how do you reheat things? Do you do them on the top of the stove? Do you bake them? A lot of serious cooks are rather snooty about microwaves.
Well, I want to just touch back on your previous question, because the other thing is, like, and you'll see this throughout the book, and I mean, this is the way we do it. It's like if I buy fish at the fish market on Saturday, I'm going to eat, you know, plan my menu so that the fish is eaten on Monday or Tuesday, right? So, ideally, you're not having to, like, freeze some stuff. You know, like, Meryl's approach, which is, like, freezing stuff for the future is great. But for that week, I always try to plan out things. Like, the more delicate foods get eaten early in the week, and the sort of heartier things get eaten later in
the week.
You
don't want them to go bad.
Yeah, no, don't want them to go bad. But I also, like, don't want to have to, like, do a lot of puzzling over where, you know, when things have to, or how they have to get treated.
Yeah. I tend to overshop, and there are probably some very way too ripe red peppers in my refrigerator right now.
I think we all do. You're tempted to do that, right? It's hard, especially if you're hungry when you're shopping.
So if it's really overripe, what do I do? Roast it? Oh. Go back to your old method.
Go back to Amanda's.
Well, it is foolproof. Just boring.
But getting back to the reheating.
Yes, the reheating. Well, we discussed this because we also are quite aware of the let's just say
the reluctance.
For some to use the microwave. We both own microwaves. We both use them. And I think that's the reality for most people. And so we give instructions for both where we feel like both are relevant. But if there's no harm in using the microwave, we say to use the microwave.
It.
I mean,
yeah.
We just embrace it. It's not like this is not.
Well, would you defrost something in the microwave, or would you? Let's say you had a frozen chicken. Would you use the old method of putting it in water and letting it defrost that way?
Yes, I think defrosting. I don't know about you, Amanda, but that's one area where I do not use my microwave.
Yeah, agreed.
But it's good for melting butter.
Chocolate.
Reheating mashed potatoes.
Yes.
Reheating, you know, any sort of puree or something that.
Yeah, I mean, we don't. The goal of the whole book is to be inclusive, like really to like help people so that they can feel like they can cook from scratch, as opposed to like putting a lot of rules in place.
Yeah,
you know, we're trying to just do the sort of so-called like dirty work for people.
But why not defrost in the microwave? There's actually a button that says defrost.
Well, I haven't really had.
Success with it. I find it. It's never an even situation. Things start to cook on the outside and they're still frozen on the inside. I don't trust it.
And then you say that you should re-season something that you've already cooked when you're reheating it.
Yeah. That's a pretty, I think, you know, typical instruction, especially for things like stews or braises, where you want them to let them sit for a day or two before you eat them. And the flavors mellow out. And so when we say reseason, we don't mean just salt or pepper, but, you know, it might mean adding a splash of lemon juice or vinegar, some kind of acidic element to brighten the flavor again.
Wine.
Yeah, or some wine. It also, I think with grain salads in particular, they really like to be reseasoned sometimes multiple times. Mm-hmm.
Does it matter whether you are a meat eater or a vegetarian? Are the different strategies?
Whether you can pull this off
reheating,
or not?
Yeah.
With reheating?
Well, all of this stuff.
I mean, I think this method or this approach is completely applicable to vegetarians or carnivores. Mm-hmm. In fact, a lot of the dishes that we kinds of dishes I think that we embrace tend to be vegetarian, grain salads, beans. I mean, there's so many great legumes lend themselves so well to cooking ahead.
And they're so healthy.
And recombining.
Yeah, and I would say that with this style of cooking, you know, you'll find that through the course of a week of menus, there's usually only like one, I would say like two dinners that are kind of meat intense, protein heavy. And then, because then you're kind of using little bits of maybe leftover chicken for, you know, a salad for another night, but you're not like having, you know, roasted chicken and then another roasted chicken later in the week.
Mm-hmm. How did you organize this book?
That is a great question.
You talked about my section.
We organized it three times.
Yes. We really wrote the book three times because each time we weren't satisfied with like our mission, which was like we really wanted it to be this handy guide and to lay out all the details very crisply for people. And so we ended up organizing it seasonally because that's how we cook and the way we sort of think about what we're going to cook.
Taking on your own personal take on seasons.
Yeah, yeah. We felt like, you know, we wanted it to be, you know, feel like the book was from us, but that, you know, we were each kind of adding our own perspectives and styles and,
we each did two menus per season so that we could have a little variety, you know, and look at, so for example, our winter menus, one of mine is actually like a holiday menu so that you could use it for having people over for entertaining. We wanted to sort of cover the bases, anything that might come up during the course of a year.
So let's say Amanda or Meryl Spring, did you suggest things to each other? Like, you know, I like that
We did.
Suggestion, but What about adding a little tarragon?
I think it was more about sort of the combinations of dishes and less about the finer details. We do that all the time because we consult each other on dishes every day. You know, what should I add to this? Or I'm thinking of, you know, tweaking this way. What do you think? I think the process that was more kind of involved during the creation of this book was looking at, you know, Amanda's menus next to my menus, and are we being repetitive or redundant, or, you know, what bases are we not covering? And, oh, that recipe that, you know, is so great that you make all the time, you forgot to include that. You need to work that in somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have a recipe, Meryl, for your red wine beef stew on our show page. Is that something that you've adapted from a brisket recipe that Amanda had turned
to? Yes. So Amanda introduced me to, it's a Mario Batali recipe for brisket and red wine in Barolo, which is not what I call for.
Well, Barolo can be very expensive.
I know. Exactly. And it really is just as good with, you know, a table wine.
$2
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment, because there are some chefs who will tell you that if you want it to taste good, you should make it in a good wine. And others will say, you know, any table wine will be perfectly fine, because once it cooks, you lose all the alcohol. And what you're getting basically is that red wine flavor or that white wine flavor.
I think my personal rule of thumb is you should be able to drink the wine that you're using alongside the dish.
Well, you're never going to use a whole bottle in a recipe.
Except for that one dish, you do use a whole bottle. That's Mario for you. But yeah, I think that's a good rule of thumb. But then again, my taste in wine can run, you know, high-low.
And then you mentioned that you use beef chuck, so that's an inexpensive cut.
Yeah, of course. I mean, especially when you're stewing. I think that's the beauty of doing a stew, is that you're making something lush and amazing out of a not expensive cut of meat.
And then, Amanda, you have a different version of it, and you use short ribs.
Yeah.
Which used to be an inexpensive cut,
right,
and have suddenly become a very expensive cut.
Well, yeah, it's not terribly expensive, but yes, it used to be kind of an unknown sort of throwaway cut, right? Mm. I like using short ribs because they're, to me, like foolproof. Like, they're always going to be kind of tender. I do really like the flavor. So I think it creates a bit of a richer stew. It has more fat in it. And I use a lot of carrots in mine.
When you talk about bumping up the carrots, what does that mean?
Yeah. Well, I don't use celery. And I usually just use like onions and carrots in stews. And I really like the sweetness of carrots and the flavor that they add to the sauce. So I tend to, if a recipe is calling for one carrot, I usually add 2 to 3.
Yeah, I think that's a great rule of thumb.
Can you roast them first to give them a little more depth?
I can roast anything.
Just gave her an oven.
You also have pancetta in your version. Is that the secret ingredient?
Well, this also, you know, they both derived from this original recipe of Mario's. And I've used bacon. I like a little bit of kind of, sort of porky bacon fat in my stews. I think it's sort of, again, with a stew, you're layering flavors. Sometimes when I'm making a stew like that, I will, brown the pancetta, brown the vegetables, and then I'll add tomato paste, cook that so to caramelize with the vegetables before adding the wine and then the tomatoes. And then, you know, if I don't have tomato paste, I don't do it. You know, it's one of those things where you could add anchovy. You can kind of add any layers of flavor that you want. But again, it's all about sort of how much time, how much grocery shopping you want to do.
Well, you mentioned that a recipe by Mario Batali was the inspiration for these two variations. When you look at somebody else's recipe, are you immediately thinking, well, what happens if I add such and such? Or do you try to do the recipe? Mario Batali is a pretty good chef. Do you just try to do it the way he does it and hope that it's going to come out as good as it does in his restaurants?
I think the first time, probably we're likely to follow the recipe as is. And then once we know what it yields in its original version, then you can start thinking about changes. I mean, there's a dish that I make all the time that's in the book called Rosy Chicken, which started as a Jamie Oliver recipe. And his recipe is actually quite different from where mine ended up. But I made his exactly as written. You know, it was chicken thighs that are sort of braised roasted in the oven with cherry tomatoes and lots of basil. And over time, it ended up turning into sort of a much more saucy version with rosé thrown in and canned tomatoes, and, you know, and cherry tomatoes. And it's become a very different dish, but it all started with this really wonderful base dish.
We also have on our show page your recipe for slow-cooked pork tacos. Does that recipe at all represent the thing you started out with?
It does, yeah. So that was inspired by a recipe for – it was really for a chili, and then it evolved into – a filling for tacos. The flavorings are all pretty similar. The spices, that spice mixture, I think that was what I was really inspired by when I made it, you know, as written the first time. And then that was what I used as my inspiration to kind of evolve the recipe to be a taco filling and add all the other components.
Do you try to stick to the traditional dishes for the holidays? Make turkey on Thanksgiving.
I think we have slightly different approaches here. I'm more of a traditionalist. Amanda goes rogue.
So what will you be cooking for New Year's?
Well, actually, I'm going to be traveling in Austria with my family for New Year's. So we're probably going to have dinner out. But then I think we'll do a grown-up, since my kids are 2 and 5. They will go to bed long before midnight. And then my husband and I will probably have a cocktail of some kind and something to nibble on later in the evening, some snacks.
Sounds great. We are probably going to do what we call a snacky dinner. Our twins are 10 years old, and so it's really fun. They love actually getting dressed up and then having sort of an unconventional special dinner, which means, in our case, sitting around the living room table and coffee table, and with lots of kind of hors d'oeuvres and cured meats, and we make them a sparkling non-alcoholic drink, and we have sparkling wine, and maybe we might get something like oysters, but like lots of kind of like little tasty bits that they can help make and plate and also choose.
A smorgasbord.
Yeah, yeah.
In the little time we have left, I'd like to know how you actually came to where you are today. Amanda, I remember talking with you somewhere in the past about an experience you had cooking in France, mm-hmm. and a relationship with a gardener. Was that when you first started cooking seriously?
I grew up.
When I say a relationship with a gardener, I meant a
platonic
professional relationship.
That's another book.
We did become good pals. You know, I think actually it all started when I was really young. You know, I grew up with a family who loved food, but weren't what you would call, not by like today's foodie standards, but interested in food. Always everything was cooked from scratch. And my mom cooked seasonally way before it was fashionable. I think that laid the foundation. And then it was actually in college when I left home and I was exposed to a city for the first time. It was Boston, and I also traveled, and I lived in London for 2 semesters and traveled around Europe. And I think it really kind of sparked my imagination about, oh, wait a second, this is something that I'm truly interested in, and what can I do with it? And I started working in restaurants and bakeries at my last year of college. So
and
it started
eventually
then.
Wound up at the New York Times,
yeah.
Writing recipes in the magazine.
Well, yeah, I was a feature writer for the newspaper for 7 years, and then I was the food editor at the magazine for a couple of years. And wrote a bunch of books, and luckily met Meryl along the way.
And Meryl, you were at Cooks Illustrated?
I had a similar path to Amanda in terms of coming to, you know, growing up in a family that was very aware of and interested in good food, and a mother who was a great cook, and also in college started cooking a lot on my own, mostly as a way of procrastinating from writing my thesis my senior year. And then I went to cooking school at the Cordon Bleu in London, and then came back to Boston. There's a theme here. And interned at Cook's Illustrated
for a little
bit.
You didn't meet there,
did you? No, we didn't. No, we weren't there at the same time.
That's Meryl's very kind way of saying that I'm older than her.
Meryl, I have the feeling you think of yourself more as a baker.
No, it's the opposite. Amanda's a much better baker than I am, actually. So, I wish I were a better baker.
I got that one wrong.
Well, and Meryl's, I feel like, is such a natural in the kitchen, and I'm much more of like a studied.
How did the idea for Food 52 come from? Where did it come from?
Well, I mean, the work that we did together on the Essential New York Times Cookbook was definitely an inspiration, because we scoured all of the archives of the New York Times for the best recipes going all the way back to the 1800s. And in the late 1800s, all of the recipe content came from home cooks. It was people writing in with their recipes for bread and, you know, for...
onion soup.
Yes, exactly. And so that was sort of, there was a kernel of inspiration there. But then we also were looking out at the world and, you know, the food world that we were so steeped in. And
now we have this new book, which is called A New Way to Dinner. It is published by 10 Speed Press. My great thanks to Meryl Stubbs and Amanda Hesser for being on our show again.
Thank you.
Thanks.